The Lord be with you. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Mark. Glory to you, O Lord. As Jesus was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a sizable crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind man, the son of Timaeus, sat by the roadside begging. On hearing that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, son of David, have pity on me." And many rebuked him, telling him to be silent. But he kept calling out all the more, "Son of David, have pity on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called the blind man, saying to him, "Take courage, get up, Jesus is calling you." He threw aside his cloak, sprang up, and came to Jesus. Jesus said to him in reply, "What do you want me to do for you?" The blind man replied to him, "Master, I want to see." Jesus told him, "Go your way, your faith has saved you." Immediately he received his sight and followed him on the way. The Gospel of the Lord. Yeah, great little gospel passage. Where are we in the Gospel of Mark? The conclusion of the 10th chapter immediately precedes Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem. The orientation matters, right? Like where we're situated matters for our understanding of what's going on in the passage, if that's what we want to do. I think that's what we want to do. So that's what's going on. There's been a lot, of course, that has happened in the Gospel of Mark prior to this, and there's a lot to come. But this is like, you know, his entry into Jerusalem and kind of kicking off the immediate approach to the Passion. It's just significant that here we have a healing miracle involving someone receiving sight immediately prior to what everyone's going to want to keep their eyes on. Because again, when we look at, especially as it relates to, say, adoration, when we look at the God whom we adore, it's very significant to see Jesus undergoing his passion and death, right? We worship the God who takes up the cross. Does that make any sense? I mean, does it make any sense in the way that, you know, would you come up with that yourself? You worship a God who takes up the cross and suffers death? Doesn't seem like the most productive or powerful thing to do, really, do you know? But clearly, what do we know? We're gathered here by the cross, you know? We're enlivened by the death of our God. So, right, I mean, talk about turning things upside down. I mean, this is what he's doing. Anyway, so that's significant. And what's significant also is what happens, I think, immediately prior to this. We have James and John asking Jesus for one of them to sit on his right and one of them to sit on his left as he enters his kingdom, right? So they're anticipating that, okay, yeah, we're going to Jerusalem. We're gonna do the thing that enables us to have the power. And when you have the power, we would like to be, you know, one and two, you know? So give us power. And of course, Jesus rebukes them for their pursuit of power. And then again, we have this, right? So in some way, like James and John seeking power are blind. They're blind to who Jesus is. So they understand that he's Messiah. They don't understand how he's going to enact his kingship, how he's going to enact God's kingship, right? His kingship as God's anointed Messiah. They're blind to it. Then we have a healing miracle of a man coming to sight at the most important time to see who Jesus is and how he effectuates his rule, how he brings his rule to bear. Okay, so these are very significant for us. But there's a lot here as well, because when Jesus enacts his agenda, he is bringing human beings to life. And so sight here is very significant when we consider that being made in the image and likeness of God being the creature that God has made to bring earth to heaven and heaven to earth, we are outward-looking animals. Right? We're creatures that have to look beyond ourselves. We look beyond ourselves in worship of God, in praise of Him, in adoration. And we look beyond ourselves to creation with a spirit of thanksgiving, right? So you recognize, against the protestations of Mary, you recognize that I've already backed into Acts. Yeah, you realize that. You realize that? Yeah, it's genius, isn't it? I can preach Acts every day. I chose not to the past couple days. I think because John was here, and every time he's not here, I feel compelled to preach Acts. When he is here, I don't feel compelled to do it. So he's going to listen to this on the podcast anyway. But sorry, John, I brought you into it again. But this is like three times for him. Anyway, it's good, the trifecta. Anyway, okay, so I'm totally distracted. Anyway, Acts. And actually, I had a friend say to me yesterday, Father, not just Acts every day, but Acts all day. Yeah. Can you believe it that there are people out there encouraging me? that's the craziest thing in the world. Okay. Acts. I know I'm so blessed, right? Acts every day and Acts all day. Okay, look, we're outward-looking animals, and we're at our best, we're outward-looking creatures. At our best, we are priests and kings. At our best, we are, say, nothing other than Acts, and praying Acts every day and all day. Especially especially when I need a reset. I think that's true, right? Especially when we feel a pinch, we have to pray Acts. Because when we feel a pinch, it means that we've lost our bearing, primarily as it relates to who we are. So I have to pray Acts, especially in those times. I'm learning that for myself. That's why I'm preaching it, because I have to hear it. I'm learning that for myself. When I feel a bit turned around, or I feel things are upside down, or I feel stressed, I need to pray Acts. I need to get back into adoration. What does it mean? What does it mean when I say we have to pray Acts? It means that I have to look towards God. Yeah. And when I look towards God, I get to adore Him. I have to adore Him, right? I'm compelled to adore Him. I should be adoring Him. Okay, better. I need to love Him. Yeah, I need to love Him. So even better than adore, because love is like more vulnerable, I think. Adore is like, good, right? I'm ready. The rallying cry and the rest. But love, I think, is more tender, perhaps. And in that sense, in its vulnerability, more important. I have to love God. But I have to love God for who He's revealed Himself to be. And He's revealed Himself to be the one who shoulders the cross and washes feet and does everything that love can do. And as soon as I see that, say, I'm loving, as soon as I'm drawn into love for that God, my view on my own life changes very dramatically. Because I'm not there yet, right? Because I'm not like constantly in that space. So my view changes dramatically to say, okay, yeah, there's a primary reality of the fact that I exist because He loves me. He has no need for me. He has no need for anything. He has all the perfections in Himself, including interpersonal perfection. He has no need for me. So I exist simply out of love, simply because He wants me to exist. That's why I exist. That's a remarkable thing. And if that's a foreign reality to you, that needs to be actually like a building block of your entire spirituality. That is just it's one of the foundational truths of who God is, right? So these are the building blocks of faith here. Okay, so I have to catch sight of that. I have to see God. I have to love Him. And loving Him, then I have some sense, of course, right? That's adoration, and then contrition. I have some sense of like, I'm also not embodying that love, like perfectly, or sometimes like very well, or sometimes at all, right? I'm not doing it at all, right? Okay, fine. But don't make that an opportunity to look in at yourself. Keep your gaze outwards, right? Even though you're catching sight of the fact that you're falling short and failing, keep your eyes on God. And if you can keep your eyes on God while acknowledging where you're falling short and failing, then you are in the space of contrition. As soon as you take your eyes off God and start looking at your belly button, you've lost it. You're not in contrition at that point. You're likely to be in self-pity or resentment. Now, this the beauty of the passage. You thought I was just drifting off. Okay, I was, but I'm coming back to the passage, you know, because it's inspired by this. Bartimaeus is, think about the blind beggar, right? He can't see beyond himself. Yeah, and not this is some of this symbolic, figurative, whatever, but some of it's really not, yeah? It's what's happening there. And the healing that Jesus is affecting in making him someone who can see beyond himself and especially see Jesus, right? That is the healing miracle, to see Jesus. Okay, so we can imagine, and people expect him as a blind beggar to be in this position of self-pity and resentment, right? And what do we see overcoming the self-pity and the resentment of the blind beggar? We see faith. Did you see it? Jesus said it. Go your way, your faith has saved you. We see faith. We see hope. Right? Where do we see hope? Okay, take courage, get up. Jesus is calling you. What does he do? He throws aside his cloak, springs up, and comes to Jesus. Right? He has hope that a healing is going to be affected for him. He has hope that he will be able to go beyond himself. Right? And he has love. I will get to that in a second because I want to stay on hope. But I'm talking about the three theological virtues there. Again, these are building blocks of our faith for good reason. Right? Okay, hope. Here's the thing. He throws aside his cloak. Why does he have a cloak? He doesn't have a cloak because Jericho is cool. It never is cool enough to wear a cloak. He has a cloak because he's begging. Right? So as soon as he hears that Jesus is calling him, what does he do? He throws aside his old way of life. And he comes to Jesus. He throws away the temptation to orient his life according to self-pity and even resentment. And he gets up and he goes to Jesus. Already hope is overcoming self-pity and resentment. And as it does, now he is being animated by Jesus as he's sent to live the life of charity, love. Yeah, so he follows him on the way. The way in early Christianity is Christianity, right? It's known as the way, which is perhaps instructive for us as well, because sometimes it feels as though the faith is a destination, right? I've landed there and I've checked off all the boxes. It's like, yeah, no, you didn't, because you can't. It's an orientation. It's following Jesus. It's the way of life of following Jesus. And following Jesus here means, of course, accepting the invitation to be renewed by him and then getting about the work of charity, serving him in all things so as to raise up his fallen world, to restore creation as his renewed image bearers. Okay, so then, of course, yeah, we're caught up in the same. Where do we find ourselves again? Whenever we're, and this is what I was saying before, right, is that we have to pray Acts all day because we are still liable to those twin devils or twin deceptions of self-pity and resentment. And whenever we're tempted to give in and start turning inwards, we have to allow Jesus to continue to affect that healing miracle in us as well, to give us sight so that we can see him, and give us faith and hope that we can follow him in charity. Yeah, and then this is, okay, he's going to the cross again. So again, fix your sight on him. Fix your hearts on him and see how he is doing, how he is enacting nothing other than the agenda of love. And, you know, you're coming into existence and being maintained in existence by an act of self-giving on God's part. Now it's ours to reflect that same self-giving, right? It's ours to reflect that that life of charity so it can pervade every aspect of our being and so also flood the entire world.